I'm Mark Wunderlich, the acting director of the University of Arizona Poetry Center, and I want to thank you all for coming this evening. First, I have a few announcements. The next reading in our series will be the postmodern poet and fiction writer Gustav Sobin. That event will take place on Wednesday, February 7th at 8 p.m. here in Modern Languages. Also, for students of creative writing, I'd like to draw your attention to two contests, the annual Academy of American Poets contest, sponsored by the Poetry Center and open to any University of Arizona student, and the Frederica and John Hurst prizes for undergraduates. Both of these contests come with cash prizes, so I encourage you all to apply, and submission guidelines are available in the lobby. Richard and Nora Dauenhauer will be present at a screening of videos on Tlingit culture produced by the Sealaska Heritage Foundation, and that will take place from 3 to 4:45 on Monday the 29th, and that's at the Center for Creative Photography, and you can call the Poetry Center for more information about that. I'd also like to ask you to take a few minutes to fill out the survey that you should have received when you came in. Surveys like this help us evaluate the success of our programs, and you can place the completed surveys in the boxes in the lobby or give them to any Poetry Center staff member. This event is made possible in part by a grant from the Arizona Humanities Council, with additional support from the Department of American Indian Studies, the College of Social and Behavioral Sciences, the Department of Comparative Cultural and Literary Studies, the Department of English, the Southwest Folklore Center, the Department of Anthropology, the Department of Linguistics, SunTrax, the College of Humanities, the Department of Women's Studies, the UA Foundation, the Arizona Commission on the Arts, and the Friends of the Poetry Center. I would like to publicly recognize Adele Barker, who first conceived the Dauenhauer's residency in Tucson and labored to raise the funds for it. Without her, this event would not be possible. And I'd also like to thank Christine Crickleway for her work on this project as well. Copies of some of the Dauenhauer's books are available for sale, compliments of the ASUA bookstore, and I'm sure the Dauenhauers would be happy to sign copies for you after the reading. In a region where the preservation of indigenous languages and cultures is an issue of great concern and importance, the work of tonight's readers offers an example of what two people have done to preserve an indigenous language of another region, in this case, the Tlingit language of Southeast Alaska. Internationally recognized linguists, and cultural anthropologists, Richard and Nora Marks Dauenhauer have, for the past 25 years, worked with the transcription, recording, and translation of the Tlingit Indian oral literature. Together, they have written 7 books on Tlingit culture and the tremendous depth and range of the Dauenhauer's work includes the production of videos documenting traditional artists, the dramatizations of Tlingit myths, ceremonial oratory, and works of poetry. The extensive list of sponsors of this event illustrates the depth of their work and the cross-disciplinary nature of it. The Dauenhauers approach their work with the Tlingit language not only as linguists, and in Nora's case, as a tribal elder, but as poets. Richard Dauenhauer is the author of 5 books of poetry, the most recent of which is Phonologies, published by Thorpe Springs Press in 1988. He's a former Poet Laureate of Alaska and a 1991 Winnerican Book Award, and has translated numerous works from the German, Russian, Classical Greek, Swedish, Finnish, and other languages. Nora Dauenhauer is the author of the volume of poetry, The Droning Shaman, and a new book of poems forthcoming from SunTrax in 1997, and is a winner of the 1991 Before Columbus Foundation's American Book Award. Nora Marks Dauenhauer is one of 2 writers creating works of poetry and prose in Tlingit. Tonight's program will consist of 2 segments, the first being the recitation and explication of Tlingit oratory, which Richard and Nora will present jointly, followed by a reading of their own poetry. I'm pleased to introduce Richard and Nora Dauenhauer.
Good evening. Can you hear me? I would first like to thank all the sponsors and Adele and Mark for having get us here to read to you.
Me too.
For the first reading, we would like to do two oratory from Potlatch, giving for Jim Marks. I think I would like to try and do the backgrounding before we start. Tlingit, as Tlingits, we divide ourselves into two parts, the raven and the eagle. And within that parts, we are also divided into many parts and represented by totemic designs. Dick is an eagle, and I'm a raven, and it shows on my disc here, I guess. And the two groups potlatch each other. I don't know if you know about potlatch. They're ceremonies performed approximately a year after someone dies. And these two oratory are from such a ceremony. And in the ceremony, or in the speeches, we talk about emblems of our people. It could be raven, it could be frog, it could be beaver, it could be terns, which is the important emblem in Jesse's. Now we'll just go ahead and start off by doing this. Okay.
Just one more thing in a way of background. If you can kind of imagine yourself now at the situation that you're at a potlatch, and the situation is that the hosts, who are the clan of the person who has died, have just sung their lamentations. There are usually four ritual songs that are sung, lamentations or dirges for the departed. And this is what is called the last cry. This is their last official mourning departed. And after this, the end of grieving is supposed to come to an end. Then in return for this, the guests who are seated, as if, for example, you would be the guests, selected from among their people, several orators, and that's what we'll be reading tonight. So we're reading, I guess, two of the major orators. And what the main speaker, who is a lady named Jessie Dalton, has done is she's brought out all of their tribal regalia that Nora mentioned. And some of them they're wearing, like hats, some of them they're holding in their hands, some of them they have on them. And she has them all lined up. So if you can imagine that there's maybe 8 or 10 people lined up here. And then the orator is going to begin speaking. And this is a little bit hard to get all of it when you hear it the first time, but if you can kind of just get that feeling. And what she does that's so magical to us is by beginning with the piece of our present, whether it's the frog hat, the wolf hat, or a raven blanket, through simile and metaphor, she brings these alive. And then she invokes not only the spirits that they represent, but all of the departed that have ever worn those or owned them. And then she's bringing everybody present. So it's not only those of you who are here present, but all of the departed are brought there. And then all of them are coming out. And the main purpose for this is to remove the grief of the hosts. And so you'll see that all the way through. So one after another, they'll have these images of this particular piece of art that you see here. All of these spirits have come to take away your grief. And that's the whole thing. So what you would imagine now is if we're the the host, then you would be the guest, and one of your people would be making the speech. Or if you're the host, then we're the guests, and we're making this. Then the only other thing is Nora's going to be doing the speech, and I am the entire audience. So you'll hear people from the audience. It's very much of a back and forth, saying things that, the only equivalent in English is sort of like amen or right on or something like that. But you'll hear me saying various things, some of which are untranslatable. So if they're untranslatable, you'll know that because you won't know what it is, but which is sort of acknowledging the speaker.
The final cry is done after a year of mourning. We weep for the deceased, but there's a taboo against weeping for an indefinite time. So we have the last cry to end the mourning. So here is David. We'll just do Tlingit first, and then I'll do a page of Tlingit because some people like to hear it. Aksanihas, Awatutek Akanian, Tuk Ayatuanuk Ye Ishtanugu, Tuk Akkagia Akkati, Kak Ishtuit Yadi, Tatkang Gokan, Yakdei Gokan, Ye Kani Ayak Akkati, Akkani Kijanai, Katush Tu, Ye Kani Akkati. Gusatan, ye yadik akquati. Hadek at iki adaya. Kajaklitz igwa. Yeati at Kakaslitz igwa. A iti nakaya hauti. Akakas. He nayugadech. Heen. And I'll stop there. My father's brothers. All my brothers-in-law, we are feeling your pain, feeling it. I will emit my mother's brother, son of Kag Ish, your child, Tathang Goakan, Yakdei Goakan. I will imitate your brother-in-law, my brother-in-law, Kidyanai, Katushtu. I will imitate your brother-in-law, Gusatan. I will imitate your child.
Thank you.
Surely, this is a hard thing to do, and it is difficult to handle a thing like this and sensitive. We are in need of my mother's brothers. The river would swell, the river. In the river, in the lake, the rain would fall on the water. When the river had swollen, it would flow under the tree. The earth would crumble along the bank. That's when it would think of breaking. When it had broken down the river, it would drop down the river. It would think of going out into the world. On this great ocean, it would drift. From there, the wind would blow over it.
Your brothers-in-law are listening to you.
After the wind would blow over it, it would begin to roll with the waves to a fine sand. When it rolled on the waves to the sand, it would drift ashore. It would be pounded there by the waves. Here the tide would leave it dry, would leave it dry. It would lie there. In the morning, sun would begin to shine on it. In the morning, after the sun had been shining on it, it would begin to dry out. My hope is that you become like this from now on. My brothers-in-law, whoever is one.
Thank you.
You created me, Chukanedi. You created me. This is why I too feel you. Yes. This is the way Huayinaka is. In this world, we're still holding each other's hands. Neither do we overlook our dead. Yes, at this moment, when the sun shines on it, my hope is that it dries out, the flowing from your faces.
It shall be.
Let it turn to joy for you is my wish.
Thank you.
You all know your brothers-in-law. your father, sisters.
You. Thank you.
This is the way it is. Yes, you will stand. The way your father's brothers used to do when such things happened. Yes, these are the things that might warm your feelings. The people I'm living in place of now, yes, used to bring these out for you to see. This is the way it is.
Thank you. Thank you.
My brothers-in-law, those who are my brothers, those who are my father's sisters, we will only imitate. There is no way they can do anything for you. You can see them wearing them. Yes, we will try. This is the way it is. This is all. This is all.
Thank you. Thank you, my fathers. Thank you.
Okay. And I don't think I'll do Tlingit for Jesse. I really like Jesse because, mainly because she's a woman. And also because she has the important part in the ceremony. You'll read when I read it. And she opened my eyes to things I heard all my life prior to studying her speech, that there's beauty in the speeches that I've been hearing all the time, and beauty that I ignored, maybe I didn't ignore it, maybe I just didn't notice. But I really appreciate Jessie. She is now in a home and still alive. And
94.
Yeah.
Yeah. We should also mention that we have this book I saw out on the table there. And in addition, our huge 900-page biography collection, which has her story in it and the life story of some of the other people we're reading. So they kind of go together. And I should also add as a testimony, this is a very important thing in my life because that's how I first met Nora. She was said, hey, look, I've got this thing here. Does this look like anything that's interesting? And I, wow, and my mouth just kind of dropped. And all I could compare it to in my own experience was Elizabethan poetry. And this to me rings very much like John Donne, especially with the conceit and the metaphor. And I was just so impressed with this. I'd never heard anything like it. And I think you'll agree with me when you hear it.
Jesse Dalton, Hunan, 1968. Does death take pity on us too? My brother's children, my father's, all my father's. It doesn't take pity on us either. This thing that happens.
That's how it is.
Which is why you their voices like this, your fathers, lest your tears fall without honor.
Thank you.
That flowed from your faces for them. They have all come out at this moment. Your fathers have all come out. They are still present is how I feel about my grandparents.
Thank you.
Here someone stands wearing one. This mountain tribe's dog, it is as if it's barking for your pain. It's how I'm thinking about
Thank
it.
You.
My father's, my brother's children, my father's sisters, yes, here. Someone is standing next to it. Hlidiek's robe, that is the closer one. Someone is standing next to it, yes.
Thank you.
It's
Thank
the beaver blanket from Chilkat. It just caught robe.
Thank you.
Tlutak, your father, it was once his blanket, once his Chilkat robe.
Thank you.
These of you, he came out. Yes, at this moment, all of them seem to me as if they're revealing their faces. Your father's sisters, my mother saying, robe, the turn robe. Yes. A person who is feeling like you would be brought by canoe. Yes, to your father's point, Kanaha. That is when the name would be called out. It is said, if the person who is feeling grief, yes, father, my grandfather's son, Kuinagas, my brother's daughter's son, Kijanai, yes, my father's sister's son, Hukenaat. How very much for your grief your father's sisters are revealing their faces. My brother's son, Katushtu, Kaksaka, my brother's wife, Ankawistan. Yes, how very much it is as if they're revealing their faces is how I am thinking about them. Your sisters-in-law, yes, they are revealing their faces. The shirt that belonged to Weha, it was only recently we completed the rites for him. The one there, the raven shirt.
Thank you.
You heard him here also, Weha, the brother of mine, this peacemaker of yours, this shirt of Weha, will remain in his hands, in his care.
Thank you.
Now it's as if he's coming out for you to see.
Yes,
how proud he too used to be wearing it, this brother-in-law of yours.
Oh, very much.
The raven nest house robe, here is your father's the father's sisters of yours standing wearing it. And on the far side is Yakayin Dishat, your father's sister. Yes, we had long since given up hope of their return. These father's sisters of yours, your father. Raven who went down along the bull kelp shirt, your father, Kadek. It's his shirt. That's the one. That's the one there. I don't feel it burned. Yes, it's the same one in which your father's brother is standing there in front of
you. Thank you.
That is why, yes, Gusatan, it will be just as if I will have named all of you. Those who are my sisters-in-law. Yes, can I reach the end, my brother's children? Yes, can I reach the end? These turns I haven't completely explained. Yes, these turns. Your sisters would fly out over the person who is feeling grief. Then they would let their down fall like snow over the person who is feeling grief. That's when their down isn't felt. That's when I feel it's as if your father's sisters are flying back to their nests with your grief.
Thank you. Indeed.
Yes, here someone stands here. My mother's mother's brother is his hat. Yes. To the mouth of Taku, he went by boat. Then for that hat, to his grandparents, It's dry in Tucson. From there, it said he acquired the frog hat. Along with it came the shirt. Yes, it also came from Taku. That is why I keep saying thank you that they're standing in front of you at this moment.
Thank you.
Yes, during the warm season, this father of yours would come out. That's when I feel it's as if your father's hat has come out for your grief.
Thank you.
Yes, your grandparents' hat. With your grief, he will burrow down with it, with your grief. He will burrow down.
Your brother's sons are listening to you.
Not that it can heal you, my brother's children, my father's.
Thank you.
My father's sisters, my sisters-in-law. And now, yes, it's like the saying, they're only imitating, lest they grope aimlessly, the way your grandparents said. That's why it's as if your fathers are guiding them. Here is one, here is one. Here someone stands wearing the hat of Yukiskukhek, this grandfather of mine. He too has stood up to face you. Yes, Kuanagas. He has stood up to face you.
Thank you.
Yes, the loon spirit. Yes, and here is the one this brother of mine explained a while ago, how that tree rolled for a while on the waves. Then when it drifted to shore, the sun would put its rays on it. Yes, it would dry its grief to the core. At this moment, the sun is coming out over you, my grandparents' mask.
Yes, thank you.
At this moment, my hope is that your grief be like it's drying to your core.
It shall be, thank you.
Hetris, yes, your father's sisters would reveal their faces from it. From Grishak, yes, that's the one there now. Someone is there with it, this headdress.
Thank you indeed.
My grandfather's headdress.
Thank you.
Yeah. And then there was a celebration in 1980. And at this celebration were all of our elders who were concerned about the language and also the state of our culture and our children. Our children seem to be drifting away and we're over here. So they decided they'll have a conference. And one of the elders brought out the group of dancers he was working with at that time and explained to them we would have to mix our genres, our songs, and our art, I guess. And so here he is saying, people of honor, the lifelines of these grandchildren of mine who entered here strand off in many directions into Kaguantan, into Tluknachadi, into Chukunedi, into Deshitan. Their lives point in many directions. This is why it may seem as if they've combined these songs their grandparents left for them. Yes, when they used them, even from long ago, we have placed our grandchildren high above ourselves. Yes, we cherish them. Even those things we treasure, we use to offer up to those who are our grandchildren. That is why now we made these songs their vision. If they're not right or if they go against your feelings, please forgive them. Yes, they will dance to Shawat Kulakan's song following this Khatan's. Is that right? That's it. And then he starts singing. That explains how we traditionally feel about our grandchildren and why we make our art and continue to do ceremonies.
We'll have a little switch into the other part of the program now. We like to do the Tlingit oratory first because it's the hardest on Nora's voice and it's the most intense. So I'm going to read some of my own poetry for about 15 minutes or so, and then Nora will be back and she'll read some of her poetry. Uh, for a change of mood here, I'm going to have a costume change, too. One of my big heroes is T.S. Eliot. To put you in the right frame of mind, and I think he's the one that said that poor poets plagiarize and great poets steal. So, so maybe you'll be think that you're in England. We have T.S. Eliot, and anyhow, here we go. We're real happy to be here, as Nora mentioned, and what I want to do for my part here is kind of give you a little sample of the kinds of work I do, my own writing and translation. And I like to compare poetry readings to weddings, because you have something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue. So I'll read some of my old stuff from a couple of older books, the frames of reference in this one called Phonologies, and then I'll read some newer things. For borrowed, I'll read some translations. I'm working on some material from Central Siberian epics, and I'll read you an excerpt of one. And that's the borrowed. And also for borrowed, I'll read some of my translations from the Greek anthology. And that's the way I'll interpret blue tonight, as sort of pornographic, because the Greek anthology stuff is at least R-rated. I left out the X-rated stuff tonight. I thought there might be some kids here. Because we're coming up on Valentine's Day, which is one of my happiest feast days of the year, so I always like to read a little bit of 2,000-year-old Greek pornography to get everybody in the mood. But anyhow, let's get in the mood. As I say, it's nice to be here. We're the snowbirds escaping from the kind of weather I'm going to read to you about, but I think now that it went almost down to freezing last night, you can identify with this. These are some poems I wrote about 25 years ago when I was living out in the outskirts of Anchorage, up on a mountaintop without any water or electricity and stuff like that. So I'll just read a few of these. It'll kind of give you an idea of that time and that place. And these are from approximately December, January, so it's the same time of the year, 25 years ago. Evening, December 1, Orion, climbing over flat top. Take the old inside so the jeep will start by morning star. It didn't. Winter now, using the wood stove to supplement the oil. December 31st, approaching midnight, silence, the sound alone of my down parka being lightly fallen on by snowflakes. January, silence and the tapping of chickadees on birch, the crunch of boots on snow. This one I call Conceptions of Snow. Those of you who are linguists or polyglots will recognize a few of the words in it. Underfoot, snyek, snyek, skiing, schnee, and first falling, snow. Snowshoe partitive, lumi, lunta, seen in sounds, dleit, neige, nyezhno, no, never, as unsound as conception of the snow. I was on a Wallace Stevens, William Carlos Williams kick, which I still am. It seems to be ongoing. So I wrote this called Nuances of Dawn. Morning star over Soldatna, cow moose still were bedded down at dusk on the frozen Kenai River. I think of Williams, Wallace Stevens, and archetypes of dawn at 25 below. January 10, 20 below, two moose on the homestead road, Orion over McHugh Peak, Telemann concerto in B-flat major, wood stove at full roar, car battery on the table by the oil stove. Thoughts while bringing in firewood, January 17th. Cold night, Orion rising over flat top by quarter moon, cold but colder low in Anchorage at minus 35 with no security of wood. Reports from the interior, how people keep oil drums on the stove to keep the stove oil warm enough to flow. reports from the interior how wonderful silence feels at 70 below. And the last from this sequence that I'll read is called Winter Walk. Recalling now that moment in Wisconsin, on a winter walk, our path met the line of tiny animal tracks, straddled here and there by brush marks till they stop. This must record some wingtips touching snow. I'll read a couple of poems from frames of reference. And I steal most of my great ideas from kids, and so I'll read a couple of poems that we wrote for I wrote for my grandchildren. This one is called A Birthday Poem for Amelia, and it has an epigraph, which is one of my favorite quotes in all of world literature. It's from Gilgamesh, where the question that's raised is, why do people have to die? And the gods answer, well, you know, being eternal and immortal isn't really all that it's cracked up to be. It's kind of dull in eternity. And it's much more exciting to be a human being because you're aware that it's a very ephemeral thing and it's going to end. And so then the god tells him, cherish the little one holding your hand. This is the lot of mankind. And that's the epigraph. Holding hands, we walk the April puddles. Look at the mountains flying. It takes a two-year-old to see stability in mist and other evaporating life. I take yarn hat and dry the playground swing after Juno rain. I know we've got some horse people in here, so I'll read one called Riding Stable. This is for Teresa's 6th birthday. Giving horsey rides, I join the children's stable. Fathers, uncles, relatives, and friends, the first time in years I've horsed around like this. I see myself a saddle-bred, five-gated, racking out, and now a Tennessee walker under mountain ash and clothesline. I want to strut my stuff, but Dominic wants gallop. So we canter with a left lead in a blending of our fantasies of horse shows and the open range in this class for two-year-olds and up. So that's a couple from there. I'd like to read a couple of older ones now. Very often I start with this next one by way of introduction about who I am, and it's called A Genealogy of Beer. I forgot to tell what time it was when I started, so give me the high sign if I should be reading faster here. The Genealogy of Beer, a blend of Beck's and Guinness Stout. And this is in memory of two of my ancestors, Timothy Donahue and his wife. The Irish plumbers spot my empty case of Guinness Stout. Amazed, they ask me where I learned to drink it. I trace my bloodlines on my mother's side, the Burkes and Kavanaughs from Galway. My mother's father's mother's side, the farthest back we go is Donahue, from Ireland, 1839, to Merrickville, Ontario. Timothy Donahue from Bandon, County Cork, who studied to be a priest. Before he was ordained, became an Anglican. How fortunate for us. And on the boat to Canada, met and fell in love. Jane Kingston, too, County Cork. So here we are, through lines of Newman. The borderline is Greer, my mother's father. English, Irish, Scotch, it all depends on who you're talking to. My father's side, transparent from the name, Dauenhauer, Daubenhuer, stave maker, localized in German wine-producing areas. We're back to Hugh, with Donahue and Dauenhue. My name's a barrel of a medieval name, emptied of its former meaning. Old names and countries always being drained, the working draft of North America, filled with spirits from around the world. One of the things that we're concerned with a lot, as Nora mentioned and as Mark did in the introduction, is Tlingit language and culture. And Several of the people who are in our biography book went to Chamawa School. So a few years ago, we had the opportunity to go to Chamawa Cemetery and sing a requiem for all of the students who had died there. And we were looking for the graves of students from Alaska who had been there. And I wrote this poem that I'd like to read. In my arms, I carry John, age one, part Tlingit, as we searched the grass for grave markers of departed Tlingit students, relatives or in-laws, when we find the 1918 graves of Aleuts whose names survive, Merkuliev, Yermanov, Rukovishnikov. I softly sing them Memory Eternal in Slavonic. A sunny day in spring, the last of April, a muggy afternoon of nettles, bees. Amtrak clacks the tracks that separate the cemetery from the old brick school building, now abandoned. Passing through to Portland, sounds its horn. Again I have baby, changing arms, keeping up the search for Tlingit names like Zuboff, Dick, and Jackson, my shoe tip clearing, polishing the nameplates on graves of those who never made it home. I'll read one called Sugar Blues. This is another Valentine's Day poem. I wrote this in 1988, but I got the epigraph the other night. We're very happy to be staying in the Poetry Cottage, which is well stocked with books, and Nora was reading Ferlinghetti, and Ferlinghetti had this great poem about underwear, and I'd forgotten all about this. It's been years since I'd read Ferlinghetti's underwear poem, so Nora was reading it to me, and he has this great line in there, and it says, "Poetry is the underwear of the soul." And I thought, that's it. This is the epigraph that this poem has been waiting for since 1988, so I'm going to read it to you now. It's called Sugar Blues, A Forefeast of St. Valentine's Day. Beyond the custom lingerie, I feast my eyes, edible underwear. Below, erotic photographs examine fine print caution at the edge of boxes. May be hazardous to health. This product is composed of saccharin, which causes cancer in laboratory animals. So I commit instead the deadly sin of pride, sweetheart. Honey pie, my fetishes embrace no sugar substitutes. A little on, more on the serious side, the most recent poems that I've done, I'll read two of. The center part of this group is called The Turning Point, and that's a point that I know several people here in the room tonight have reached when mommy and daddy no longer take you, but you take care of mother and father in their declining years, and it's the kind of experience that we all go through at some pivotal point in our life. And these are two poems from that. Empty House of Childhood. Memories echo in the stillness of the night as I return and enter. No one home answering the telephone or door. Your latest stroke has meant intensive care across the city. Traveling from four time zones away, I turn the key and hear only the tick-tock of heirloom clocks, metronomes of other times of life. I settle into silence and adjust. And my father's ritual every morning is his fire, winter, summer, rain or shine. He likes his fire. And I finally, I think, begin to get a feeling for this. This is called Dad's Daily Fire. Like orange maple leaves on branches, flames in each log, sustaining fall well into winter. Or as hands and fingers rise, a ritual salute to morning victory in skirmishes with death. I'd like to read a couple of real short poems from the Greek anthology, and then I'll read this excerpt from the epic to finish with. This is my borrowed and blue stuff. The only thing I have in way of lectureship to the younger generation here is each generation seems to think it's the first generation to invent sex. So that it's a very humbling experience to read Greek poetry from 2,000 years ago. and not only recognize the emotions, but realize that that's where we got a lot of our symbolism, like Cupid and his arrow and all of this kind of stuff. So here's Cupid's arrow for you. This is by a gentleman named Asclepiados, who was flourishing around 270 B. I can identify with this poem from my college days, so this is for all the guys in the audience here. The winter night is longer than the stars and stormy. Back and forth I pass her door in darkness, rain-soaked, wounded by desire for her who treats me with deceit. Not love did Aphrodite strike me with, but grief. The red-hot arrow sizzles in the rain. Good stuff, huh? All right. Okay, this is one for the ladies in the crowd by a guy named Kapitonos, and we have no idea when he lived. It's a very short one, but this is for the ladies. Beauty without charm just pleases us, but does not hold, like bait floating without a hook. Okay, good stuff here. Meleagros, this guy lived or flourished 90 C, and he was the first editor of the Greek Anthology, which is a collection of poems that took about 1,000 years to put together, from about 200 BC to 900 AD. So here's Meleagros, another good one here. Tamarion, your kiss is glue, your eyes are fire. Look at me, I smolder, touch me, and I'm stuck. Another one by Meleagros. Asclepias, lover of love, with clear blue eyes, launch and voyages of love. I meditate on that one. Marcos Argentarios, another writer well represented in the anthology, probably around 1st century AD. You do all the work, Melissa, of the flower-loving bee. I've learned by heart now how you let the honey drip from your lips, sweet kiss by kiss, then how you sting me when it's time to pay. One of my favorites is Rufinus, and we have no idea when Rufinus lived. Some people think he was the Roman period around the time of Christ, others that he was Byzantine around 500, so just no way. But I translated this one for Nora 20 years ago, so I still like the poem. Rufinus has a lot of poems about getting older, so I kind of like that too. These other guys are always chasing the eternal chicks, but Rufinus, I think, was in there for the long haul here. I see you now, my lady, with your iridescent hair, now raven black, now lighter, but still the same brilliance graces it. And still the same God of love will dwell within it when your hair is gray. And I'll read one more here. Paulus Silentarius, he lived or flourished in the 560 AD, and he was an official in the court of Justinian in Byzantium, otherwise known as Turkey these days. So this will get you in the Valentine mood here. Let's throw away our clothes, my lovely, lie naked, flesh to naked flesh entwined. Let nothing lie between us. Your sheerest next to nothing seems a fortress wall. Let breasts and lips be yoked, the rest be veiled in silence. Kiss, I hate a wagging tongue. Okay, I'd like to finish up now with this, a little change of pace now. This is a very brief excerpt, but it reads, I think, fairly rapidly from the Altaic oral epic called Ochibala. And let me just say a couple of things about this. This comes from Altai, which is in central Siberia. And Ochibala means younger daughter. And the thing that really intrigued me about these epics, that when I started getting into them, this particular one from Altai and one that I've just finished, which is twice as long as Beowulf, called Alamji Mergen, is the role of women. And, you know, we have the stereotype that these guys are real macho. You know, these are the Turks, the Mongols. This is Genghis Khan and the boys. But in the epics, the women play these incredible roles.
And the one I just finished, the hero gets killed off in chapter 8, and it's his sister that comes to the rescue, and she has to go through all these trials and tribulations, win the bride for him, bring her back, restore the brother to life, and so on. And this one that I'm going to read, Ochibala, the bad guys have usurped the kingdom, or the Khanate, and what I'll read now is the very end of this, where she comes home and just cleans up and kills these guys left and right. And I imagine her as kind of an Altai Wonder Woman, you know, with the bracelets and the whole nine yards. And she's rappelling down into this cave where this guy is kind of a slob. And you can see he's been guzzling all of her wine and her stuff and eating them out of house and home. And now she comes rappelling down into the cliff into the cave with her sword, and she's going to just clean up. Now, the only thing that I can say by way of apology is all of my translations end up sounding like Beowulf. So that could be good or bad, depending. But the original is an 8-syllable line, sort of bum, 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 bum. And it's sung, and it's accompanied by a lute, or it's a thing called topshur in Altai. And it's also throat singing, if any of you have ever heard throat singing, and don't ask me to imitate it, but they can do two or three voices at once, and they and then it's kind of whistling. And they can get both of them or three of them going at the same time within octaves, and it's the most incredible thing you've ever heard. And so they kind of chant the story, and then they go into this throat singing. So you'll have to imagine that, because none of that comes through in the translation. So anyhow, here's the end of Ochibala. And this is for the ladies in the audience and Adele and all of the... I know we have a lot of feminists here who've contributed to getting us down here, so this is for the ladies in the audience tonight. Younger daughter, Ochibala, unlocked the entrance to the subterranean chamber. She let down a line into the darkness and lowered to the top of a huge boulder with a sheer cliff face. The brownish rock was bright as before, shining like the moon. It was flowing with silver, glowing with gold, and a clear sunbeam. But an icy wind from the undimming cliff filled the dead quiet corners of the cave in a blood-chilling wave. Great Khan, most radiant giant, tell me now, is Ochibala standing before you, or the cold cliff? If you can't believe your own eyes, then come on down and feel me for yourself. Not stopping to wipe spit from his face, he looked at her with his bloodshot eyes and knew at once he had mistaken Ochibala for the shining boulder. Until that moment, he had rejoiced. Khan Taji had boasted of his strength, but now in impotence, he tore out his hair, tuft by tuft. Said Ochibala, well now, does the wine I gathered here taste good enough for you? Well now, is the arak that I distilled strong enough for you? Well now, how does my golden toast of welcome strike your soul? You came to my Altai with war. You thought you'd try to finish me. My nation is not meant for misfortune. My people do not live to perish. Our herds are not grazing to be eaten by your shabby horde. Do lords not live under the moon, their light to be clouded, eclipsed by me? The man is not yet born who can overrun Altai and lord it over my people. I was born to live in freedom. My father I call an enormous pouring sunbeam, and one of the gentle moonlit cliffs I've called my mother for centuries. You wanted to disgrace our peaceful girls and shame our sisters. Two times you started war, twice you overran our land. You're too greedy. You need to be punished. You wanted someone else's land as carrion to drag in the dust. Hardly had the high thunder of her speech ended when the mighty Ochibala cut Khan Taji Bey in two with her flashing sword, broke Ail Khan in pieces. Taking up huge boulders, she covered his bones with a stony mountain so the Khan would never rise again to his dying day, to the end of his years. Now 70 Khans scurry in a row in submission. Now 60 Khans rush in reverence all at once. Then little sister gathered her people and gave instructions. The fountain of our misfortune has now dried up. Khan Taji Bey exists no more, and all that's left of his court and palace is a smoking mountain. Drive off the livestock of the Khan. Graze now where the grass is thick. Warriors lead the people to their lawful places. And low bows to the earth, the Khans bowed down before her who freed her people. And they all made songs to the glorious girl. Thanks.
Let me see. What was I going to read? I'm going to read Dancing with Machines or Salmon Egg Puller. While my voice can still function. Salmon Egg Puller, $2.15 an hour. When we used to go to the canneries a few years ago, when salmon industry was thriving in Southeast Alaska, there was a lot of salmon, a lot of egg pullers, a lot of cannery workers. We don't do this anymore, but we do think about this, and I'm one of those who still think about it and talk about it. So here's a salmon egg puller. What we did was we took the roe from the salmon, and when they came to the canneries, they had to remain cold or kept cold so that they'll remain fresh. So here it is. Salmon egg puller, $2.15 an hour. You learn to dance with machines, keep time with the hitter, swing your arms, reach inside the salmon cavity with your left hand, where the head, grab lightly top of a sack with fingers, pull gently but quick. Reach in immediately with right hand for the lower egg sac. Pull this gently. Slide them into a chute to catch the eggs. Reach into the next salmon. Do this 4 hours in the morning with a 15-minute coffee break. Go home for lunch. Attend to the kids and feed them. Work 4 hours in the afternoon with 15-minute coffee break. Go home for dinner, attend to kids and feed them. Go back for 2 more hours, 4 more hours, reach, pull gently. When your fingers start swelling, soak them in Epsom salts. If you didn't have time, stand under the shower with your hands up under the spray. Get to bed early if you can. Fingers are sore, start dancing immediately. The pain will go away after I see fish with aches. And I'll read. Something from my new collection. I like to read this poem from my grandfather, Jim Nakatak, who was blind and nearly deaf. It's also thinking about way life that's passed. I was telling my grandfather about what was happening On the boat, my father and his brothers were trying to anchor against the wind and tide. I could smell him, especially his hair. It was a warm smell. I yelled as loud as I could, telling him what I saw. My face was wet from driving rain. I could see his long eyebrows. I could look at him and get really close. We both liked this. Getting close was his way of seeing. And my poems are really short, very few long ones. This one I call Grand Canyon 2. It's for Joanne Townsend, who was here a couple years ago, just before we were. Grand Canyon 2 for Joanne Townsend. All my senses are alive out on the edge, from my toes to my fingertips. They play tricks on me, become raven, circling over me. Every hair on my head seems to reach for him, ready to pull me over from Maricopa Point to Precambrian. I wrote this one for my friend from one of the villages. And it's just a sample of Whetston's food is like. I guess you've heard of subsistence foods. It's very getting into politics now, and we don't know if we'll still have subsistence foods. Ernestine's house, Huna, 6 a.m. I woke to smell of smoke, of fresh wood crackling from the stove mingled with the feeling of Brown Bear Den clan house, radiating family's care. The taste of smoked deer meat coming out of container of seal oil. Caverns of memory. And now I would like to read a play that I wrote for, what is the theater called now? Nakahiri Theater. Nakahiri means clan house. So this is a play I wrote from two Raven stories. Or one Raven story told by Willie Marks, who is my father. Characters are storyteller, Raven in white, then black, Ganook petrol, props bottle of soda, dog doo-doo in tube, or dog mess, real or fake, water wheel made from roots, bentwood box container, black gauze for the smoke, music, Raven song, Dia Kanagudi. White Raven walking along a beach. He was looking for water. There was no water. There was never any water for people to drink. But he thought he'd look anyway. Only after it rained would people get to drink water. But there was someone who was known to have water. The one person who had water was Ganook. Ganook lived out on Dekinu. But Dekinu was way out there on the ocean. He was Raven's brother-in-law and the grandfather of the Alaska Native birds. Raven paced back and forth on the beach. Every now and then he looked out at Dekinu. Raven, how can I get out there? And then an idea. Raven, I think I'll go out there on a trip to see my brother-in-law, Anuk. And flew way out there, nearly dead from dehydration. Raven landed on Dekinu. He was so weak, he almost collided with his brother-in-law. He said to Kanuk, "Hey, partner, how are you? I'm just out here on a small vacation. I asked for administrative leave. I have a paid vacation, but I didn't get any per diem. Can I stay with you?" Kanuk hardly said a word. He would do only "hermph" in a while. In fact, he wouldn't talk to Raven at all. Raven thought, he has an attitude problem. No matter what Raven said to him, he didn't answer. He stayed by his water. He was preoccupied with his water. All he did was sit on the lid of this marble container for his water. At times he would sit by the container, but he never left it. Once in a while he would stand by it to stretch a while, hanging on to the lid, just to make sure the lid of the water was on straight and that no one bothered it. Still thirsty, Raven thought, how can I get that water? He was so thirsty. His mouth felt like it was coated with glue inside. He imagined Perrier in green bottles, spritzers in all flavors, Italian sodas, birch beer, root beer, and tum water. And where am I? He wanted Kanuk to get up from his water and leave the marble container so he could open the lid and have some. He thought, I must get that water. An idea! While Kanuk was asleep, Raven brought in some dog doo-doo. Holding the dog mess gingerly, he smeared the bottom of Kanuk with it. Raven thought, I hate to do this, but I've just got to have some of that water. The doo-doo smelled. In fact, it was the smelliest smell he ever smelled. Then he started to shake Kanuk by his shoulder to wake him from his sleep. Raven turned his head away from the smell of the doo-doo. Raven kept telling him, hey, partner, wake up, hey, wake up. Kanuk slowly opened his eye, looking up at Raven. Raven continued, you did something there. It's all over your bottom and it smells bad. Yuck, 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 yuck. Hey, partner, you have to go out and clean yourself up. You got a problem there. It's gross. I think you should go outside and wipe it off. Kanuk was sheepish and embarrassed. Raven, pew, yuck. Raven gagged at the smell. This was when Kanuk went outside to wipe the doo-doo off. Even he could hardly stand it. He was gay too. As soon as Kanuk went out, Raven, avoiding the smear on the lid, grabbed the lid off the water and threw it aside. He stuck his head in, and with all his might, cluck, 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 he gulped as much water as he could. He swallowed the first of it. Just picture Raven, so skinny, look, drinking all this water. He was very skinny, you know. While he was still gulping the water, Ganu threw open the door, yelling at Raven, "Are you at it again? Are you at it again? Are you, my precious water? You never stop, do you? You do, but Raven." At that, Raven flew out the smoke hole. "Caw!" Ganook at the same instant yelled, "Grab him, my smoke hole spirit. Grab him." The spirit at the smoke hole grabbed Raven. Although he flapped his wings, he couldn't move. He flapped his wings in one place. He kept on flapping there at the smoke hole. Then Ganook built a fire under him. He used pitch-soaked wood because it makes good smoke. It was tough for Raven, especially when the smoke was billowing up. His eyes started to water. His eyes were running, and he wanted to sneeze from the smoke. He was inhaling smoke, and he wanted to cough so bad. But he thought, "I've got to keep the water for my children." Over the smoke hole, he flapped. He kept on flapping. Oh, that smoke. Won't he ever stop putting on the sapwood? He just flapped there. The white raven was flapping, you know. Raven was white before Ganook's fire. He was originally white. He had the water in his mouth and inside of him. He held it in his mouth with all his might while he was flying at the smoke hole. It was very difficult to hold the water. His eyes were bulging from the pressure. It was tough for him, but it was for all the people and for the world, so that everyone and all the animals could drink fresh water. Ganu continued to smoke him. He piled his wood high. Only after Raven was so black hunk of coal, Ganook said, "Spirit over my fire, let Raven go. Let him go." With the last of Raven's strength, he flew away, looking like a little hunk of coal in the air. By this time, he could hardly hold the water in his mouth. He thought, "I'll try to hold the water, even if some of it dribbles." He dribbled from his beak. These dribbles from the corners of his beak made the streams in southeast Alaska. This is what became the streams. "An idea. I'll spit some out," he thought. Maybe the water he spit out made the first rivers. The huge rivers coming down from the north, the Yukon, Copper, Elsek, Chilkat, Taku, Shtukin, and the Nas. But when he was naming them, who wrote it all down? Was there someone there with a pencil and pad to transcribe his story? Anyway, this is how Raven spit out the rivers by mouthfuls throughout the world. Then he designed the waterfalls, the falls that don't have lakes at the head. Even today, you could see the waterfalls pouring from the mountains. Raven thought, "How shall I design the falls?" An idea. He gathered the mountain ferns, called Shatlukwetliti in Tlingit, and he wove them into a wheel. While he was spinning it like a wheel, he spit water on it as it turned. Spit out the water that he still had left in his mouth. After he spit the water on the wheel, he rolled the wheel holding the water over the side of the mountain. The wheel released the water as it fell. This is how Raven made the waterfalls on the mountainside. This water flows in a circle. That's why it never runs out. This is how we got the water in the world. This is how Raven invented the hydrogen cycle. I'd like to read one more and then I'll quit. Last summer, a bunch of Hawaiians came to Juneau, and everybody was expecting them, and things were happening to welcome them. There were dinners being organized, and some of the ladies from the ANS and the corporation got together and organized their powwows or their luaus. And so I got ready and wrote my poem. The name of the canoe that they made out of Southeast Alaska cedar is Kotkayanaha Kayatan, which means steering by the stars. So the name of this poem is Constellation Course Hanging Loose. Extreme anticipation. You are like medicine to all of us. All the Thlingets of Southeast Alaska were as if in a tide pool, churning when we heard the Hawaiians are on their way. From Ketchikan, we heard of you. From Wrangell, Petersburg, Angoon, Hoonah, Haines, all your ports of call. When you were nearing Juneau, as news of you grew stronger, the tide rushed in full bore, taking us along on a current of anxious to see you. Symptoms of love medicine, smitten, helplessly waiting to see you. Anticipation to the max. Aloha. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. I hope you'll join us for a reception.